In the first part of the 20th century, George Gershwin found fortune as a composer of popular songs, which were used in dozens of Broadway and Hollywood musicals, many of which he created with his brother, lyricist Ira Gershwin. But he also made his mark on the classical world with, among other works, many solo pieces for piano, the great American opera Porgy and Bess, and a number of classic orchestral works. Although George Gershwin died in 1937 at age 38, his music has lived on in films and TV soundtracks, in revivals of his musicals, and in new stage productions. His signature orchestral work, Rhapsody in Blue, is performed by orchestras throughout the world. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers George Gershwin and his musical legacy.
Backstage at the Kimmel Center, Philadelphia Orchestra principal clarinet Ricardo Morales played the opening of Rhapsody in Blue.
I had to try to think of being free and try to have a lot of spirit and fun with it, because that's basically how the glissando even came to being.
He says during the rehearsal of that first performance of Gershwin's 1924 work, the clarinet player was having some fun with the opening scale. The composer liked it and wrote that glissando, gliding from note to note, into the score.
From a joking manner in the rehearsal, it just became like the standard way of playing the piece.
Musical exploration, after all, prompted the entire work's birth. Bandleader Paul Whiteman had asked the 25-year-old Gershwin to compose a concerto for a concert which was to be a musical experiment, says Temple Associate Professor of Music Ted Latham.
The idea was, how far could you push a concert band, a jazz band, in terms of breaking into the classical world? And Gershwin's piece was the linchpin for the whole thing.
Conceived on a train ride from New York to Boston as a musical kaleidoscope of America, created in about 4 weeks, the work emerged from Gershwin as a free-flowing, one-movement rhapsody. Within this classically recognized form, Gershwin developed several themes, as a conventional classical work would do, but also used harmonies and rhythms reminiscent of jazz.
I played this for one of my teachers, and he said to me, "Michelle, this isn't Chopin."
Curtis student Michelle Kahn, who performed the work earlier this year with the New Jersey Symphony, says making a detailed written score sound like an improvised art form like jazz is not easy.
There's tempo changes everywhere. Almost every couple measures, he writes in, "I want the tempo to get faster here. I want there to be a retard here, which means to slow down, and then suddenly go back to tempo." And I mean, it's so many instructions in a way that makes me look at it methodically. But yet, you have to find a balance, because if you think only methodically, then you lose a lot, really. You lose the charm, you lose what jazz is.
An example?
It goes from this forte, big orchestral, you know, proclamation to this little dance. I mean, he's kind of joking with you. Actually ask you to slow down, and the listener is, oh, what's about to happen, you know? Is this going to be one of those very mellow moments now? You know, he set us up for that, but then suddenly he picks up speed again.
The key to making the work sound improvised, says the Philadelphia Orchestra's Ricardo Morales, is compromise and flexibility.
That is basically the trick on all good music, which is that there are a lot of things that Gershwin does, also Bartok, and there are many markings that seem extreme, and the page and the score looks extremely busy, but it's in Mahler also, there's a million things that are going on and very many specific markings in terms of color, tempo, style, yet it's meant to be so that then it has a very natural flow to it.
Many critics didn't know what to make of the experiment bridging the separate musical worlds of jazz and classical, says Temple's Ted Latham.
The popular critics said, well, it's too stuffy. And the classical critics said, well, it's, you know, sort of a hack piece. And the classical critics were responding to this music that sounded too jaunty, too easy, too much fun.
And yet?
It's really the work that put him on the map as a classical composer. Up until then, he was known as a Broadway composer and a Tin Pan Alley songwriter.
A successful Broadway composer who had gotten a job at 15 on New York's Tin Pan Alley, a section of 28th Street between 5th Avenue and Broadway, home of major music publishers and the place where songs were written and banged out on old pianos by song pluggers like the young George Gershwin. The second of four children, Jacob Gershwin, born in Brooklyn in 1898, was called George by his family. He later changed the family name to Gershwin. Growing up on the streets of New York when jazz was also on the rise, George took eagerly to the piano his parents had purchased for his older brother Ira. With a gift for lyric melody, he became successful early, writing song after song. His first big hit, 1919's Swanee.
Swanee.
Once he had commercial success, which came to him relatively easily through his songwriting, he wanted critical success. He wanted acclaim. He wanted to be considered a serious composer.
Lacking formal training, he sought lessons from composers Nadia Boulanger, Maurice Ravel, and Arnold Schoenberg, each of whom turned him down.
All of them said, "You're a great composer already. Why mess with what you have going?" They saw the potential in him to merge these classical and popular genres.
From the early 20s, Gershwin composed dozens and dozens of songs and multiple works in different genres. In 1924, the same year he wrote Rhapsody in Blue, he began working on popular tunes almost exclusively with his brother Ira, who had become a lyricist. The musical Lady Be Good was the first of a string of Broadway shows he did with Ira at the rate of one or two a year into the early 1930s. Among them, Funny Face and Strike Up the Band in 1927, Showgirl in 1929, Girl Crazy in 1930, and Of Thee I Sing in 1931. For orchestras, he wrote his piano concerto in F in 1925, and in 1928, An American in Paris, which became the inspiration for the 1951 MGM film.
That piece has a great deal of elements that are very much in the French school of writing in terms of having very precise orchestration and a great deal of different colors by mixing different sections of the orchestra, winds and strings or brass and winds, etc. And it is really magnificent. Of course, it's such a fun piece. You always feel like you just want to give it your all, and actually it's a bit of a dangerous part because you have to really balance all the intricate things, because there's many things that happen very quickly and one has to obey much more the orchestral markings, the dynamic markings, etc., for the textures to come out.
Second Rhapsody premiered in 1931, Cuban Overture in 1932. In 1936, he wrote Catfish Row for orchestra and the film score for Shall We Dance, only a year after the opening of his opera, Porgy and Bess, about African-American life on the South Carolina coast. Soprano Karen Slack has sung the work with the Opera Company of Philadelphia under artistic director Robert Driver.
It is absolutely the best known American opera.
The music is black music, but it's also just jazz, and it makes you feel like you're not separated. You know, sometimes the Italian music, the French music, the German music is like, it's not our culture as Americans. Forget color. It's about our history as Americans.
Not only did his works range from pop, jazz, classical, and opera, individual pieces transcended all genres. In 1937, while working in Hollywood, Gershwin collapsed from a brain tumor and died after surgery. In pictures, George Gershwin appears as easygoing and natural as his music, flushed with success rather than struggle.
But these stories about him constantly improving his craft, seeking out new teachers, even if he was rejected, trying to learn orchestration, really give you a different picture of someone who was very consciously honing his craft and working hard at it.
Gershwin is one of those that the more one gets to see, there's more and more layers to the work that he does. He's really one of our American geniuses, for sure.
What's very exciting to me is that I'll speak to friends of mine that aren't in the musical world about concerts that I'm playing. When I say I'm about to play Rhapsody in Blue, oh my goodness, I mean young and old and everyone, oh, I know that piece. And people, they get so excited when they actually know the piece.
Music, where the serious and whimsical can meet, and where the difficult looks easy. Perhaps Gershwin's greatest legacy is his gift of so many melodies, in whatever context, that reach across time.
WRTI's Susan Lewis.
Everything you hear on WRTI is made possible by members. Please join today.